You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 23rd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Writing in the Jacobin, Jonah Birch on the poverty of culture. Also on the program today, congratulations, everybody. It's a new war. U.S. strikes in Syria. Hitting targets in northern Syria, including ISIS. And we got a new target, the Khorasan. And, of course, the Nusra Front. Yes, folks, it's a small world, after all. Also on the program today, a wonderful letter to the editor from Randall Paul's early days of being a libertarian, where taxation was theft. White House intruder makes it through the front door of the White House. Google drops Alec, and the Treasury steps up actions to make corporate inversion far less profitable. ...102 activists either summoned or arrested yesterday at Flood Wall Street protests on a day when supposedly the UN was going to deal with climate change. I imagine they now have some other things that are taking up their time. Last night, U.S. began a airstrike campaign, an air war, I guess, kinetic activity in Syria, joined, if not in the air, but sort of supported, if you will, with these airstrikes, was a group of Arab states, including Bahrain, Jordan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. So we've got some new friends and some old friends joining us. Apparently, the U.S. notified Syria that we were about to bomb their country. We did not, according to the U.S., get permission. We did not give specifics. The Assad regime says the opposite. There was no attempt by the Syrians to shoot down any of our planes, but of course they don't have a lot of their SAM missile systems and the West. My guess is that we at the very least informed them, and they said, oh great, we'll take the U.S. Air Force as our Air Force for the time being. And now we're bombing a new group. According to the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, as they are known, that American forces alone took action, i.e. bombed, a network of seasoned al-Qaeda veterans from the Khorasan group in order to, quote, disrupt an imminent attack planning against the United States and Western interests. I don't know about you, but I'm a little skeptical that we were actually able to send a Hellfire missile or some type of drone missile or into the conference room where they were actually imminently attack planning against the United States. We'll obviously talk more about this as the program progresses, but at one point we should ask ourselves, now that we are basically $2 trillion into this global war on terror, now that we have killed several hundred thousand civilians, we have also suffered over 5,000 military casualties, deaths, I should say, tens of thousands of military injuries. Maybe it's not working. I mean, if we're still going after al-Qaeda splinter groups, I don't know. I'm just getting the feeling that maybe we need to take a slightly different tact on this whole thing. But let's wait another 10, 12 years. Expend another $2 trillion, kill another couple hundred thousand civilians, create millions of refugees, and then let's reevaluate it again. Let's just call it another FU, another Freedmen Unit. We were just commenting as the show began in one of our show opens, we have Thomas Friedman explaining his rationale as to why we needed to go to war in Iraq. 10 years ago, I think he said this on Charlie Rose, and it was punctuated with his suck on this. And I knew if we kept it in the opening long enough, everything would circle back. So don't throw out those wide ties or those skinny ties, fellas. Because that and our compulsion to bomb people will always come back in style. We got to take a break. Just a note, we are aware that updating iOS 8 on the iPhone crashes our app. We have submitted now an update to the app. The turnaround time right now in the App Store seems to be anywhere from 6 to 9 days. Hopefully it will be up there. We have Kyle has put in major fixes. The IM window resuming playback after a call and keeping the stream going in bad network conditions. It's going to be much improved. You can pick up the app today at majorityapp.com. Remember, it is your memberships which keep this show alive, both the free show. And then as a bonus, we give you another 50 minutes of membership show. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com or just head over to majority.fm. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. When you click on our Amazon link and buy your crap through there, we get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's a great company. It's Just Coffee, literally, dot, not the word, but the thing, dot, C-O-O-P, it's because it's a co-op. All right, we're going to take a break when we come back. Jonah Birch.
Last night.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Jonah Birch, a sociology graduate student at NYU, writing in The Jacobin, The Poverty of Culture. Welcome to the program, Jonah.
Glad to be here.
So, Jonah, let's talk about this idea of a culture of poverty among Black Americans. I mean, we hear about this quite a bit from right wingers, and we hear about this in a general sense too. That there is a cultural mindset which breeds poverty, as opposed to poverty functioning on people. Just give me your sense of why you wrote this piece.
I mean, I think that we decided to write this piece, in response to the aftermath of Ferguson and what was happening there, and certainly events there, I think highlighted a lot of the issues of racism in America today, and the very deep-seated inequalities facing Black people in this country, really affecting every sphere of social and economic life. The endemic problem of police violence, of course, and police brutality, and then on the other hand, the inverse of that, the response to the protests in Ferguson that followed the murder of Michael Brown, reflected just as you said, the pervasiveness of this analysis, this idea that essentially, the problem facing Black people is not so much racism, or maybe that's a part of it, but is the sort of cultural pathologies of the Black community, very deep-seated cultural pathologies. And those ideas, the idea of a culture of poverty among African Americans has very old roots and very famously, that was something that was central to the Moynihan Report, written in the mid-1960s, but it's really become the sort of the standard explanation, the standard way of making sense of the fact that in decades after the end of formal segregation, legal segregation in the South, you still have just enormous, enormous disparities between Black people and white people in this country.
I mean,
Go ahead. We just, we wanted to go through, and people, we're certainly not the first people to be, this isn't the first article to be talking about this and the debates around this. And it's really been a central focus of some of the discussions in recent months. You can think about the debate between Ta-Nehisi Coates of The Atlantic and Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine about precisely this issue. But we wanted to go through some of what appear to us to be some really basic tropes that are central to this sort of idea of the culture of poverty, and look at them and really deconstruct them, because I think a lot of them, the evidence suggests that they're not founded on, reality, but reflect an ideological disposition that's bogus, that's bogus and is tied to a politics that blames Black people for racism.
And I want to touch on the sort of the wide swath of political figures, and you touched on a little bit about that debate between Ta-Nehisi Coates and Jonathan Chait. And I want to get to that, but first let's go through some of those tropes, because you start with the notion that going to prison, the belief that within Black poverty culture, or however that is defined, that the notion of going to prison is almost a rite of passage to be celebrated by Black men. Talk about that trope.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that in the United States today, going to prison is almost a rite of passage for Black men, in particular, lower income, poor Black men, and particularly, Black men with with lower levels of formal education. It's a chronic problem, and the rates of incarceration, of course, are astounding, and that's well known. But the idea that reflects a culture that celebrates incarceration. We're trying again to go through some of the studies about this, and that's not, you know, that's not grounded in reality, that notion. And there's quite a bit of evidence that, as one might expect, Black families don't want to see their kids go to prison, and feel a sense of shame. And it's something that is, a tragedy, not something that people see as a good thing. And if you want to look at the roots of incarceration rates, the starting point and the ending point, I would say, is not the cultural values being inculcated in Black youth, but in the way that people are criminalized and, in those sort of entrenched inequalities in areas like employment, income, access to education. That has to be, that has to be the focus. If you look at the statistics around things like white teens and Black teens, the rates at which they use or sell drugs, white kids are more likely to be using drugs and alcohol or to be selling drugs. Rates for things like violence or weapons possession are very close for white and Black teens. And yet the rates for incarceration, the rates at which Black kids are detained and then sent to jail for those things, is just astronomically higher. I mean, that's about discrimination. It's not about the cultural failures of the Black family or the Black community.
I mean, it is sort of stunning that one even has to assert that and actually go out and prove, and you cite a couple of studies in your piece, that Black families would not promote or not be happy with the idea that their family members are being incarcerated. But this is just the very fact that this needs to actually be said. It would never even occur for anyone to ever write a piece that, like, white families don't want their family members to go to prison. But yet that is indicative of what is sort of like problematic about something embedded in this perception. And you make the point that studies have shown that when it comes to teaching their kids about obeying rules, Black families place a higher emphasis on obeying rules, and that's basically in obeying authority. That's basically a survival tactic.
I mean, of course. if you're a white kid in America, and there are lots of white kids who don't have it great in this country, of course. But there are lots of things that you just don't think of as being a danger, or a threat. Your interactions with all sorts of institutional authority figures, whether it's police or, certainly that's a central one, but various other types of institutions too, it's not going to be the daily threat of, being arrested, of being punished in the way that it is for Black kids. So of course people respond to that, Black families, by trying to emphasize strategies, behavioral strategies, that are designed to lower the likelihood, that a Black kid is going to get arrested, or stopped. And the statistics in New York City, people have a, because of all the discussion about things like stop and frisk, a good sense of some of the disparities in stops and in arrests. But that's really a national thing. I mean, Black kids are just much more likely, Black people, to be stopped, whether in their car or on the street, than white people all over the country. That's just a fact of life.
Let's address it. You also break down three other prominent claims that are inherent in this this narrative of black and black poverty culture. One is that black students devalue education out of some notion that studying hard is a white thing. And we should say, you know, at this point, we hear this as much from, you know, the, you know, figures like President Obama and Bill Cosby, as we do as anyone from the right. I mean, to what extent is that inherent in black culture?
I mean, you know, I think that's a really good point that you make about, you know, about how pervasive that notion, particularly around things like education or employment, the idea that there's a cultural failure or problem in the black community, in those areas, those ideas have a lot of traction, you know, among liberals and among particularly, you know, policymakers and people who are sort of more mainstream observers in the media. You know, and if you talk to Bill O'Reilly, if you watch Bill O'Reilly's show, he'll just deny that racism is a problem at all. When he's presented with statistics about disparities and incarceration or arrests and all, he thinks it's all a big lie. Well, of course, you know, Al Sharpton or Barack and Michelle Obama, you know, that's not their response. There's an acknowledgement that there are problems of discrimination, the police, and the education system, but that acknowledgement is invariably tied to some sort of lecture about you know, directed at you know, at black families, black people, about the need for them to change their behavioral norms and you know, and their attitudes towards things like school. And Barack Obama, you know, President Obama has consistently emphasized that. Whenever, on those rare occasions when he does talk about race or racial inequalities, you know, people might remember on the campaign trail in 2008, you know, there was the famous figure of Cousin Pookie. You know, he's saying in every speech, he's saying to black audiences, people have to get off the couch. Michelle Obama saying, you know, we have to stop seeing education as a white thing. That has to be something that we value. You know, and that's not, the evidence doesn't bear out. You know, that's what's going on. If you want to look at disparities in educational outcomes, you know, the problem is not with black kids who see, you know, doing well in school is selling out or acting white. Of course, it's in the variety of very entrenched inequalities that reproduce, that maintain the disparities of generations past around that stuff. In the area of employment, I think it's even starker. People, you know, probably have some sense that there are huge gaps, and they're actually getting wider right now in terms of unemployment, underemployment, low-wage employment, the types of employment people get, median household income between blacks and whites in the United States. But actually, since the start of the Great Recession, one of the things, and the EPI, the Economic Policy Institute, wrote, you know, an interesting, you know, reported some interesting findings in this regard that I think we cite in the article. Actually, you know, black people are more, they keep looking for jobs longer than whites do, even in the face of what are consistently much worse employment, you know, possibilities for them. People aren't dropping out of the labor market. They're trying to find work. So the notion that, you know, as Joe the Plumber said, if they had held the job fair in Ferguson, the population would have scattered like cockroaches, which, you know, he put it in very brazenly racist terms. But the underlying notion that people don't value work, the problem is they're not looking for work, they're not trying to better themselves, you know, those are ideas that are shared by, you know, President Obama and people like Al Sharpton at times. You know, that notion is a total fallacy. And it papers over the variety of factors that are, you know, that are maintaining those kinds of inequalities in employment. One study that we don't cite, which had a lot of influence in sociology, about a decade ago, a professor who's now at Harvard, looked at, basically at, she had, a pair of black and white, job seekers go out, and look for work. One put on their resume that they, had a felony, but they were previously incarcerated. The other said they weren't. You know, and she sent them out to look for entry-level jobs all over the Milwaukee area about a decade ago. She found the findings of that study, which were, you know, got a lot of attention in academia, maybe less so outside, were that the white job seekers who reported to their potential employer that they had a criminal record, that they had a felony, were still more likely to get a callback for the job than the black job seekers who said they had no criminal record, all else being equal. You know, and that's a really stark finding about employer discrimination. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about employer discrimination. What people are talking about, you know, is it's black people that have to change. That's where the problem lies, you know, and that's where the solution has to come. And that totally distorts the reality of the situation.
Do you, I mean, I want to get to the broader questions of what the intent is on that distortion. But before we get there, let's also talk about the another element that you mentioned, the notion that black parents place a low value on marriage and stable family life. I mean, again, right, this is another thing that we hear where, you know, we hear these black men being admonished, you've got to be a good dad, as if it's like it doesn't occur to them that they want to you know, I mean, both, I mean, it works both ways too, right? I mean, because in some ways we see, you know, this sense of like almost surprise or extra praise on black men for being good dads, as if they're like overcoming their cultural destiny by becoming dads who care about their kids. And this is just, it's absurd.
Right. You know, and certainly, I mean, let's just say that for everyone in general in American society, rates of single parenthood, out of wedlock, childbirth, divorce have gone way up in the last 40 years. You know, and middle-class white people who are single parents are definitely not stigmatized in the same way that, say, you know, black women who are single parents are, you know, white kids who come out of families where there's been divorce, where their parents are split up, you know, don't face the same sort of judgment, the same sort of, condescending, discrimination that black kids in those situations do. It is, of course, true that rates of single parenthood and are higher in black families than in white families. And there's a variety of reasons for that. A lot of it has to do with things like mass incarceration, and differentials in employment rates. And what that does in terms of the possibility, people getting married, people maintaining stable family units, that's not, you know, the response to that, you know, certainly can't be just a lecture towards black men that they need to get their act together, which is invariably the way that's framed. The almost universally shared belief is that, you know, there's some problem in the black community where black people just don't value family. And then, all the evidence suggests the contrary, you know, that the problem is not about whether people value family, but about the social context that, you know, that people find themselves, find themselves in. And it's a way of shifting the discussion away from some of those social factors and back towards individuals and claims about their failures. If you want family units to stay together, well, what you have to do is create social and economic conditions that are going to allow that. And that means, you know, invariably, it means dealing with mass incarceration. It means dealing with, disparities in employment. Mass unemployment, of course, disproportionately affects black, you know, black communities. You know, and it means dealing with the enormous inequities in things like access to social services or different types of educational resources. That has to be the response there.
Yeah, indeed. And you know, it is on some level, you know, we've talked about this topic, particularly out of Ferguson, this notion, at least within the context of the black community, where we hear President Obama, you know, he has a program, My Brother's Keeper, which is a response to, you know, it's a cultural response to a problem that is more a function of policy and systemic issues. It's focusing on the individual. And we hear this, you know, referred to as respectability politics, this notion that, you know, African-American leadership needs to sort of project this notion of, you know, these problems, you know, we've got to clean up our own house, too, before we can expect things like not to be harassed on the street by the police, et cetera, et cetera. But the broader dynamic of focusing on sort of these a culture that is endemic to the individual or to the group seems to be the best way to avoid having a conversation about dealing with societal problems that are a function of the way our system is set up.
You know, sometimes you just think to yourself, if people could just take a step back and look at the way in which some of these issues about black culture are framed and how the absurd double standard at work. I mean, there are advertisements, you know, on television stations in major cities across America telling black kids that they have to pull up their pants. You walk into any, you know, high school and you look at white kids, you know, adolescents in this country, you look at the clothes that they're wearing, the way that kids are talking to each other. You know, you just can't tell me that there is some fundamental difference in the dressing habits or, you know, modes of interaction of, you know, of black kids. The way that rap music is stigmatized as this, you know, vehicle for inculcating, for promoting violence and sexism. And then you're like, you know, you turn on the television and you see WWE or, you know, the wrestling, you know, which the fans were, which as far as I can tell, are almost all white. And it's, well, where is that? Where is the recognition of that? You know, and of course, it's a way of shifting. If 40 years ago, liberals, certainly people on the left, were talking about issues like full employment. They were talking about, you know, some of the more structural, more fundamental issues of racism in this country. And that really has disappeared. You know, I think you can say, and they made a lot of headway. They're really the notion that at least one of the fundamental problems is the culture of black families and black communities. That notion has really gotten a lot of traction. And so, you know, after Michael Brown's funeral, Al Sharpton, who routinely he's a prominent, you know, certainly voice and advocate for dealing with issues of police violence and racism. But he could get up at Michael Brown's funeral and say, you know, we have to get our act together. We, you know, there's a basic problem of black-on-black crime. You know, kids today, the way that they address each other, well, you wonder why we face this kind of, you know, discrimination. There's a bizarre disconnect at work where, you know, an unarmed black kid was killed for nothing. You know, and the responses in the New York Times running a piece, he's no angel, Al Sharpton getting up at his funeral and lecturing the assembled audience. Well, you know, that just strikes, I think that would strike any reasonable observer as bizarre. But that's the political context that we're operating in right now. That's the moment. You know, and that's been the trajectory of politics around racism for, you know, certainly for the last 40, 50 years.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's certainly a value on the and I'm not sure to the extent that that framing is adopted consciously or unconsciously, like by someone like Sharpton, by someone like the president or by someone like Bill Cosby. I don't know if that is a tactic or if that's been absorbed. I mean, I know there's plenty of data out there that shows that even black people think that other black people are on welfare at higher rates than they are.
Right.
And because that has been the sort of the feedback loop here that our society has created this narrative. And it becomes much more convenient to deal with it. But it reminds me of the narrative that we create around education, where the problem is there are individual teachers who are not holding these kids to account, as opposed to structural problems with poverty. Or even, and maybe this is a little bit of a stretch, but it's a similar dynamic. Look, you can't be out there complaining about global warming and have an iPhone in your pocket when where it's about sort of the individual when we are talking about far greater forces that are working on and create these problems or these structures in society. But Jonah Birch, the piece is in The Jacobin, The Poverty of Culture. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll link to it at majority.fm.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
All right, folks. Just quickly update you on what we know at this point in terms of the strikes in Syria. And this is just the beginning. Understand that. We're probably only a couple billion into this thing, and we're not going to be done until we spend at least a half a trillion. What do you say, folks? I know that we have the gumption to do this. I mean, forgive me for being so flip about this, but it's pretty stunning. I mean, and I don't know if we will know for a while just all the jockeying that has gone on. Like I say, we are the strikes happened in three waves, this is according to the Pentagon. The first targeted Khorasan, this the latest Al Qaeda spinoff that we now perceive as an imminent threat to the country. Apparently, was it who was it? Alexander, did you say was in front of was testifying earlier this week? I'm sorry, Clapper from the NSA testifying that Khorasan has shown up on the radar now. Who knows why we have decided now to strike Khorasan in this thing? Maybe it was a trade-off for one of our so-called partners. Maybe they didn't particularly like the leadership of this group. Maybe this was a threefer for the Obama administration. Who knows? The next two waves targeted ISIS militants, including their in towns on the border of Turkey, where apparently ISIS or ISIL has taken over a number of towns in the past couple of weeks. Obviously, that's an issue for the Turks. We also attacked what is the, I guess, the ISIS's sort of de facto capital, the city of Raqqa, I believe it's pronounced, and some of the bases around Raqqa. There were other strikes in Deir al-Zor and Hasaka provinces, as well as oil wells controlled by ISIS as a way, I guess, presumably of diminishing some of their revenue sources. There were also strikes in Iraq, supposedly to create space for the Iraqi security forces to reorganize. The United States proud, again, to stand shoulder to shoulder, according to President Obama, with Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, Jordan, and the United Arab Emirates. So today, at a day at the UN, where we were ostensibly going to see talks on climate, they'll still go on, but I imagine they won't have the same sort of sexiness and urgency that they would have had the other day. Kevin Drum had a piece where he was addressing Andrew Sullivan's question as to who's going to pay for this. But what I thought was more interesting, rather than the sort of sudden surprise that people don't care about the deficit or the debt, was Drum just put it very starkly. We finished Iraq War 2.0. We're now, I guess, theoretically in 3.0. But 2.0 cost anywhere from $1.5 to $2 trillion. I'm not even sure that includes the costs of dealing with veterans. But just contemplate for a moment what a $2 trillion government infrastructure project in this country, or $1.5 trillion infrastructure project, what benefits would have seen. Kevin Drum pointed out that had there been a $1.5 trillion investment program at that time, as opposed to a $1.5 trillion investment in a war that has left half of Iraq occupied by the most terrifying terror threat since the last most terrifying terror threat, which may not even be the latest most terrifying terror threat now that we have the Khorasan. But he said that we'd be having hearing after hearing on how ineffective and crony-ridden the $1.5 trillion infrastructure project was. There'd be government reports on its cost-benefit balance. There would be calls to end it in tout court. But a massive government program can be seen as a form of welfare dependency for the actual countries, Turkey, Iran, Jordan and Kurdistan, facing the crisis, gets almost no scrutiny at all. Indeed, we don't even see any evidence that Congress is going to vote on Iraq War 3.0. I imagine we've had more hearings on Benghazi than we have on anything associated with that $1.5 trillion that we spent on Iraq 2.0. It really is confusing where they won't name this. It really is a problem, and someone should get on this. Maybe we should try and come up with it. Operation Flying Security, Flying Freedom. One would hope we will have a name, because this thing's going to go on for a couple years at least, seems to me. And something that lasts that long should have a name. So if folks want to call into the program at 646-257-3920 or I am me. Let's name this thing, folks. The first one was enduring freedom. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
The second one was, I can't even remember what it was. Freedom? All right, we will take a break. We're going to figure this out. We're going to figure out what all the names were and sort this out so that we can get this thing properly marketed to the American public. I'll tell you something. If there's not trading cards, I'm going to feel really cheated. Really cheated. All right, we're going to take a break. Don't forget, we need your support to continue this program. 646-257-3920. Coming up in the fun half, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about these our new war. But we will also touch on the arrests at Flood Wall Street. Fun story about Randall Paul back when he was a biology major. And his belief, I wonder if he still has it, that taxation is theft. Hey, if you're one of those guys who believes that taxation is theft, or that the professor we had on a couple of months ago to defend libertarianism did a poor job, and you want to talk to me about freedom, please call in 646-257-3920. We've actually opened up a special phone line for libertarians. It's 646-257-3920 and guaranteed to have diminished line quality. Google drops Alec. Long time coming. And Treasury Department fights back against inversion. All that and more. We'll be right back after this. You can IM me at Majority FM or via the app. First IM of the day. Sam, I will not update iOS until you get the app fixed live. Can live without a new iOS. Cannot live without the Majority Report. I love it. We'll be back in just a moment.